Stay with us. There's lots more to come. Okay, and you are listening to KFAI, and we are radical lesbian feminists talking about doing alternative world economies. And the song we just heard was from Sweet Honey and the Rock. It's called Are My Hands Clean? And seemed to be a nice way to introduce the next little bit that we want to talk about. We're going to talk about what International Women's Day is, the political significance of it, and then we'll read some poems by worker women before we get in later on into a discussion about welfare and alternative economies. March 8th is an international observance, International Women's Day, and it commemorates ordinary women and their struggles for equal rights. In 1857, on March 8th, women garment and textile workers in New York City staged a protest against inhumane working conditions, the 12-hour workday, and low wages. The marchers were attacked and dispersed by police. 2 years later, again in March, these women formed their first union. In 1908, 15,000 women marched through New York City demanding shorter hours, better pay, voting rights, and an end to child labor. They adopt the slogan, Bread and Roses, with bread symbolizing economic security and roses a better quality of life. In May, the Socialist Party of America designates the last Sunday in February for the observance of National Women's Day. In 1909, the first National Women's Day is observed across the United States on February 28th. Soon, I don't know how they do March 8th on February 28th, but anyway, soon women in Europe began celebrating Women's Day on the last Sunday of February. In 1910, Clara Zetkin, a German socialist, proposes that the International Women's Day be observed to mark the strike of garment workers in the United States. The proposal is accepted by the Women's Socialist International at a meeting in Copenhagen, but no specific day is fixed. In 1911, on March 25th, more than 140 working girls, mostly Italian and Jewish immigrants, die in a tragic triangle fire, an event that will have far-reaching effect on labor legislation in the U.S. In 1917, Russian women call for a strike on February 23rd for bread and peace, protesting against poor living conditions and food shortages. This date, the last day of Sunday of the month, according to the Julian calendar, then in use in Russia, falls on March 8th on the Georgian calendar, widely used in most European countries. In 1977, in December, the General Assembly adopts a resolution proclaiming the United Nations Day for Women's Rights and International Peace to be observed on any day of the year by member states in accordance with their historical and national traditions. For the United Nations, International Women's Day has been observed on March 8th since 1975. And the day is traditionally marked with a message by the Security General. I just thought it was really important to bring up the socialist roots of International Women's Day because we live in such a capitalist country, and whether we like it or not, any country who thinks it's a socialist country really basically has to live by the gross national product and the United Nations economic structures. And basically, the world is not run by governments anymore. It's really run by multinational businesses, which is basically a capitalist foundation. So we just thought it was really important to commemorate workers and think about what socialist economies might mean for us, or at least some alternative ways of doing economy than the way that it's being set up for us right now. And so we'd like to read a couple of poems that speak to that, and then we'll go back to another musical break.
Poems by Elena Dykewoman, and she wrote this pretty amazing poem about the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory Fire. And the inspiring, of course, was that where 146 workers, almost entirely Jewish and Italian women, died within 18 minutes of the fires starting. The high death rate was attributed to not following the safety and fire regulations according to the company's policy of keeping the fire doors locked to prevent employees from sneaking out. Over 120,000 people marched in the funeral procession. And this tragedy reoccurred in 1993 in a toy factory outside of Bangkok. Fire locked doors, jumping women, over 200 dead. The poem's called A Law of Physics by Elena Dykewoman. One body falling alone is its own weight, times distance. Two bodies falling alone are their own, but If they hold hands, their weight is multiplied. Here's a for instance. Two girls are on a ledge. The building is burning. There are nets below. The girls are young and, for the purpose of this example, thin and frightened. It is 8 stories to the ground. The net can hold 90, 120, 150 pounds times the distance, but holding hands, they become 11,000 pounds on impact. The net breaks. No one knows the price of comfort. How much they loved each other and expected by jumping, neither to live nor die, but fly, released from the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory.
The second poem is by a woman named Sue Darrow. She's a worker, a mother, and a resident of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and she's written several books of poetry about her experiences. She worked in the Soo Line Railroad machinist shop, grinding axles and doing other sorts of very hard factory and precision machinist's work. And frequently she worked on a night shift. And she writes poetry about her fellow workers and about the work and about being betrayed by the union. Even though she, I'm sure, believes in the principles of union organizing and so forth. She's written, the book that I'm going to read the poem from is called Blue Collar Goodbyes. She's written another book called Heart, Home, and Hard Hats, which I've also read, and I can recommend both of these books of poetry. They're really good. So here's a poem by Sue Darrow about a fellow worker of hers, and it's called Verona, Your Life. Is a victory, and your story should be told, how your blue-collar work began at the railroad in Milwaukee at the end of the Second World War. You'd been a waitress in the cafeteria till it shut down after the men came home. Not much sense, but that's the railroad. The waitresses were told to make a choice, become laborers or quit. Some of them tried, one of them stayed. Who said the war was over? You fought a battle every day they didn't want you there, and that was every day you worked. The foreman had you hauling rocks in a wheelbarrow from one pile to another to make you tired, to make you give up. Instead, they got tired of watching. You were a Rosie the Riveter who would not go away. You raised your kids on railroad wages, grew your muscles strong as the sturdy plants on your Wisconsin windowsill. Your life as full as your wheelbarrow, your smile as long as your seniority. And I was proud to work with you those last few years, even if we were on opposite shifts. You came to work a little early, I stayed a little late, and our shifts meshed like a set of perfect gear teeth. Until the railroad was sold and our jobs derailed like a train wreck, it seems another war was over without a bullet ever fired. I knew I'd be out the door, but thought there might be hope for you. Then the bulletin board did the dirty work. You'd been laid off with less than a year to go till retirement. They wouldn't let you work your remaining days in the wheel shop, even though it was to stay open for some time. They wanted only one laborer, and he had more whiskers in the union, and he was a he. But hey, here's a deal, they said. You could sell the home where you raised your family, leave your grown children, friends, and grandchildren, and move to Minneapolis for a job of unknown merits. You said no, and retired at 60, with a pocketful of severance pay and your family at your side. After all, this wasn't the first time the railroad demanded that you make a choice, and your decision was right. Both times.
I am a union woman, just as brave as I can be. I do not like the bosses, and the bosses don't like me. Join the NMU, come join the NMU. I was raised in old Kentucky, in Kentucky born and bred. But when I joined the union, they called me Russian Red. Join the NMU, come join the NMU. This is the worst time on earth that I have ever saw. To get killed out by gun thugs and framed up by the law. Join the NMU, come join the NMU. Bosses ride by
And that was Robin Flower with Join the NMU. And we'd like to finish out our last few minutes here, our last 15 minutes, talking about bringing it into local focus and starting off a little bit to talk on some reasons why we as radical feminist lesbians feel like it's a need to talk about women in the economy and talk about alternative strategies. And to put this in, to frame it a little bit, I'd like to read a section from the welfare reform bill, because I think that's something that's really affecting us quite directly these days. It will also encourage you to stay tuned at 2 o'clock, because there will be some women in here talking for a half hour about some implications of the welfare reform bill, which we won't get into, but I do want to read this section of it, which I think pretty much is pretty horrific and kind of sets us up for some things, especially as lesbians. It is the sense of the Congress that marriage is the foundation of a successful society, and as an essential social institution which promotes the interests of children and society at large. The negative consequences of an out-of-wedlock birth on the child, the mother, and society are well documented. Yet the nation suffers unprecedented and growing levels of illegitimacy. In light of this crisis, the reduction of out-of-wedlock births is an important government interest, and the policy contained in provisions of this title address the crisis. Congress finds that marriage is the foundation of a successful society and an essential institution that promotes the interests of children. Promotion of responsible fatherhood and motherhood is integral to a successful child-rearing and well-being of children. It is the sense of Congress that prevention of out-of-wedlock pregnancy and reduction of out-of-wedlock birth are very important government interests, and that the policy contained in provisions of this title is intended to address this crisis. This document makes it clear that under which conditions child rearing should exist. I think we can also assume from this that Congress feels that the role of what the role of U.S. women should be, namely that our socialization has always said, heterosexual, wife, mother, caregiver. It's based on a very specific definition of family values. Women are responsible for reproductive, unpaid labor. By reproductive, we mean not only being wife and mother, but also the larger context of reproducing culture, caring for aged and sick people, taming male sexuality, providing more guidance to the community at large. It's, as we've always known it, a form of economic control over women. And one of the books that I've been reading recently that really brought this home for me is a book that's called Regulating the Lives of Women, Social Welfare Policy from Colonial Times to the Present, written by Mimi Abramovitz. And she says, on the individual level, the family ethic keeps women in line. Fulfilling the terms of family ethic theoretically entitles a woman to the rights of womanhood, including claims to femininity, protection, economic support, and respectability. Noncompliance brings penalties for being out of role. Encoded in all societal institutions, the family ethic also reflects, enforces, and rationalizes the gender-based division of society into public and private spheres, and helps to downgrade women on both. The ideology of women's role helps to keep women at the bottom of the hierarchies of power in both public and private spheres. Indeed, the idea that women belong at home has historically sanctioned the unequal treatment of women in the market. The resulting economic insecurity has channeled them back into the home. The need for women's domestic labor and the ideological presumption of a private sphere to which women rightfully belong has helped to rationalize their subordination in the public sphere. Where industry's need for inexpensive labor drew women out of their proper place, the idea that they belonged in the home justified channeling them into low-paid, low-status, gender-segregated sectors of the economy and into jobs whose function paralleled those tasks traditionally performed by women at home. Women's inability to earn a livable wage made men, marriage, and family into an essential, necessary and more rational source of financial support. Lacking a material basis for independence, women easily become economically, if not psychologically, dependent on men, which in turn created the conditions of women's subordinate family role. In brief, the family ethic, which locked women into subordinate family role, also rationalized women's exploitation on the job. By devaluing women's position in each sphere, the ideology of women's work and family roles satisfied capital's need for a supply of readily available cheap female labor. By creating the conditions for continued male control of women at home and on the job, the economic devaluation and marginalization of women are muted, and the challenge that increased unemployment by women posed to patriarchal norms. So it's clearly that the family ethic doesn't include the values, the realities, the lives, the family structures, or the work of lesbians, and that we stand outside this structure. And for me, as a radical feminist lesbian, I see this role as an outsider, as potentially strong and powerful to work against these oppressive economic systems. And as we've seen, though, some of the international forces at work in the world consume capitalism and multinational corporations, so we do what we can. And so in a little bit of time we have left, we want to talk about some things that lesbians have been doing. Do either of you want to start this off?
Well, one thing that occurs to me right away in terms of the things that lesbians have tried to put together as alternatives is a project actually that Mary Les, who couldn't be here today, uncovered in the Bay Area of California, called LEAF, which is really it's not exactly an alternative economic system or an alternative institution as such, but is a kind of a way to redistribute the wealth in a really small physical or geographical area. And it stands, LEAF stands for Lesbian Emergency Action Fund, and it has two components, a voluntary contribution from middle-class lesbians on a regular basis towards funds, I mean just liquid cash funds, that are then distributed to lesbians in need. And there's another subcomponent, actually, of that part of grocery shopping, buying, which the middle-class lesbians do, and the working-class poor lesbians and the lesbians in need are the ones who make all the policy decisions, determine who receives the assistance and who needs groceries and who needs cash and who needs what. And then the political education component is a series of workshops or seminars or consciousness-raising sessions, whatever you want to call them, by the middle-class lesbians. They take charge of that part, working on their class oppression stuff, re-education.
Such as middle-class lesbians are also middle and upper-class lesbians.
I've always heard it said middle-class lesbians, and I don't know whether there are upper-class lesbians participating in that particular organization, if you want to call it an organization. I assume that it would be open to women with wealth as well. I don't know that much details about the actual women who are in that group.
Mm-hmm.
And I assume that it also shifts from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
I really like the political education component of it. That seems like, I mean, I like the redistribution of the wealth thing too, but it doesn't address basic problems. And
right.
I think that the political education part is really, really crucial in terms of any kind of long-range change about understanding how the class structure in this country works and how it particularly affects lesbians,
mm-hmm.
Who, as you pointed out, don't fit any place in the kind of the way they have it organized.
Right.
So. And the other thing is, with our group, we were discussing a couple months ago doing a sort of exchange of services, in that where if you have a particular thing that you no longer need or that, you know, someone else might be find useful, that you would put it in a centralized area and people can just come in, take whatever they need, no questions, no nothing, drop off whatever they want to drop off. And I kind of like that idea.
So it's sort of like instead of having a garage sale, you would take all that stuff, clothing or appliances or furniture or whatever it is, to this central location, and then other lesbians could come and you wouldn't have to drop something off to take something, as
right.
I understand
no.
it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a free exchange. So you take what you need and leave what you don't need and pass it around.
Right. Yeah.
And I've also heard that described too, as not only just with stuff but also with labor and
skills,
so that if and wasn't there somebody who was coming up with time dollars, the idea of time dollars like in neighborhoods. Somebody mm-hmm. was talking about maybe like the Frogtown area around here does that, but I've also heard it in lesbian context too, where and part of the idea behind that, which is something that I wanted to try to remember to bring up, is that one of the things that was really popular in the 70s among the lesbians I know was that you would try to take your money and your hard-earned women dollars and give it back to other women's services, so that if you needed a doctor, you would call a woman doctor. If you needed a mechanic, you'd call a woman mechanic. If you needed a carpenter, you'd call a woman carpenter, you know, and try to keep the money within our community. I know that that's really something that's done among some African-American communities, and it's something that was really widely done by many lesbian communities that I know of, and it seems to have died out over time, and that's something that I would really like to see us bring back, is that, you know, that we really try to have our work and our labor and our money be really focused towards other women, because women have so few accesses to so many resources. You know, and I think that there's, you know, whenever you have somebody coming into your house or wherever, you know, to do whatever kind of work for you, there's always the, you know, harassment and whatever that goes on with that. So if we could diminish that for ourselves and really take care of other women. I mean, even like driving services, like there was some cab services, that kind of thing, mm-hmm. women who would drive each other around so they wouldn't have to be taking public transportation, you know, on city streets at night, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So
I really like the idea of the trying to keep the money amongst women and lesbians. And I think that it probably still goes on nowadays, 20 years later, whatever. It's just that we do it more as individuals, and mm-hmm. it's not as obvious, and it isn't so much in community, and maybe that's just a reflection of the changed political times and how communities have been somewhat dispersed or diluted, lesbian communities, in the in these past years. Mm-hmm. One of the things, the other things that from the 70s that I remember from living in a fairly rural area in New England, which worked incredibly well in terms of exchange of services, and was not, I actually don't know how they measured things. It was not in dollar hours or anything like that, but this was a small town in New England where a lot of lesbians lived. The percentage of lesbians in this community was very high, and I'm including the outlying areas of this village as well. And those women set up a work exchange system to kind of like they used to do completely routinely in rural U.S. and rural pretty much everywhere in the entire world, as far as I understand it, of helping get a certain task done so that mm-hmm. When Mary and Eleanor decided to get their wood in off the woodlot for the winter, then the whole crowd would come over,
right.
and one would operate the chainsaw, and the next one would drag the stuff to some sort of central set of locations, and the next one would drag it to the next location, and so forth. And then it was somebody else's turn the following weekend,
right.
or whatever. And so people got greenhouses built that way, and they got their wood in, and tons of different tasks right. were done. And it was wonderful,
yeah.
and it's hard to say, you know, whether the community came first or the work exchanges built the community, but it's one of those kind of organic things that really works, and that's how people got their crops in years ago,
right?
So forth.
Well, we are rapidly running out of time here, but this is a conversation that we are continuing to have as a group, and we meet monthly, usually on the third Thursday. Although this month we've changed it to the fourth. The 27th of March, and we meet at Sabathany Community Center. So if you are a radical feminist lesbian and would like to participate in these conversations with us, you're welcome to come on March 27th at Sabathany at 7 o'clock. If you would like to call us about more information about the group, the phone number to call is 721-4352. And I'd like to encourage you to stay tuned to KFAI, because we are doing a lot more programming on International Women's Day, and there is a crowd of women who are going to be coming into the studio at 2 o'clock to talk about welfare reform, which I think is something that really desperately needs to be talked about, and they're going to talk about implications for women. So thank you for listening, and we hope you continue listening to International Women's Day, and we're going to go out with a song by Alex Dobkin, which we think pretty much describes it all. So here is Alex Dobkin singing If It Weren't for the Women.
If it wasn't for the women, we would not be living. We would not be joyful, singing, loving and beloved again. If it wasn't for the women, we would not be living. We would not be joyful, singing, loving and beloved. Keep going. If it wasn't for the women, what would we do? We wouldn't have health or strength or beauty. We wouldn't have a home. We wouldn't have food. If it wasn't for the work of the women, if it wasn't for the women, we would not be living. We would not be joyful, singing, loving and beloved. Women, if it wasn't for the women, what would we do? We wouldn't have art or crafts or music. We wouldn't have love. We wouldn't have truth. If it wasn't for the work of the women, if it wasn't for the women, we would not be living. We would not be joyful.